the estuaries. That's where you get the mixing of the fresh water from the rivers and the streams with the salt water of the sea. If people think that estuaries are valuable for anything, it tends to be for the bird life, because they're big, they fly around and they're obvious.
Gulls and guillemots and razorbills and that sort of thing, and cormorants and shags, loads of those out there.
But in actual fact, they're equally important for huge numbers of fish, and the mudflats are alive. We're telling people how an area of mudflat is productive as a rainforest. Obviously it's not sexy, but there's a much life growing there as a rainforest. I think that's quite incredible. So the amount of energy going into the system from estuaries is quite colossal. And with our interest at the moment in carbon dioxide, estuaries and some of the habitats within them are locking up huge amounts of carbon dioxide. So it's vital that we really look after them for their own right, for ours, and also, of course, for the wildlife. Debris from the rivers, from the land, washes down into the estuaries. Debris comes in from the sea. It settles and it just gets locked up in the mudflats or locked up beneath the seagrass beds or the salt marsh. And because they are on the whole quite stable habitats, it's locked up there for a very, very long time.
I first came here in 1956 to collect weed for my PhD work in London, and then in 1958 I got a job at Plymouth, ideal. But I've travelled all over the world with seaweeds. This beach is a very good example of the types of seaweed we get around the shore here. We've got a very good, the trouble was, I suppose, that the MBA, that's the Marine Biological Association where I worked, had studied this shore ever since it was formed over 125 years ago, and had published on it, and therefore people realised this was a good place, but it's also a very good tourist place. And so came to a difficult situation, and we said, well look, let's have a what we call a honeypot for the tourists and teach them how to behave reasonably on the shore, and hopefully they won't go a bit further along where we can have the seaweeds that we want to study and carry out experiments and that if we want to. You attract everybody to one area, be prepared to lose some of the value of it, and then have the pristine bits further along the coast. Well, the University of Plymouth do quite a lot of experimental work here on the effect of grazing, animals grazing, and also on the effect of the interaction between weeds, plants and animals. And we also have here, unfortunately, this brown seaweed further out, which came in from Japan in 1977, or it came via France. And this is an invader, an alien as we call it, and there's a lot of work now going on as to how it's competing with the native weeds. In fact, I'm going to a seminar tomorrow at the MBA with someone who's doing some work, I think probably here, on the interaction, I think it's at Salcombe, on the interaction between this weed and the zostra, which is the native grass in the estuary. But over there, there's a weed called Ascophyllum nodosum, a long weed, which grows hanging over the rocks. And these rocks here, if you look, are bedded that way. Do you see what I mean about the angle of the rock? And so you've got a sharp edge here. And people walking across the seaweed, this cuts it off. And you're losing the seaweed. And this particular seaweed that's there takes a long time to grow. It grows about that much every year. And it's been trodden off faster than it's growing in some places. And at the end of the summer, when we first used to come here, I could stand up in the car park and you could almost see footpaths out across the rocks where people had walked out and trodden off the weed. But then you've got to allow people to enjoy the environment to some extent. I mean, that's what the area of natural beauty is for people to enjoy it. the path is there for them to walk and enjoy it. You've got the green weed at the top of the shore, then you get the brown weeds in the middle and the red seaweeds lower down. And there are many varieties of each, and the different species occur at different levels, different tidal levels. And if you drop me on the shore somewhere, I pick up the seaweed, I can tell you where I am in relation to tidal levels. This is the aim of the centre. We've got a warden there in the summer, you see, who brings school parties down to Rockpool Rambles, as they call it. And she is spending her time now in the winter going round to the schools, giving them talks before they come here to try and get them to understand what they should do and what they shouldn't do. And it's been a great asset. I was one of the founders of this, together with Norman Holm, who's dead, unfortunately, Dr. Norman Holm. And we realised that this was a place. We had a dreadful job getting funding for it. I think it's been open 20, 25 years, I'm not sure. It's the Mewstone, which is just a rock, really. It's a bird sanctuary. It's full of nesting birds, gulls and guillemots and razorbills and that sort of thing, and cormorants and shags, loads of those out there. The only problem is that there were rats there a little while ago, and the bird people have been trying to get rid of the rats because the rats were a menace for the birds. But it's uninhabited. There is a little cottage there, which you can just about see if you know where it is. But the story is that somebody lived there once. And there's all sorts of weird stories about this person who lived there and what happened, that sort of thing. But in Victorian times, people used to be rowed out from here to have tea out there. It was a sort of tea venue. You're not allowed to land there now. During the war and after the war, when the gunnery school was up here, the Naval had a big gunnery school on the hill up there, they used to fire right over there the target. But there was a wonderful story, and apparently it's really true, that if ever a gun misfired, the instruction was aim at the Mewstone. And they'd put the gun pointed at the Mewstone in case it eventually went off late. And so the naval command now, if a gun misfires at sea even, aim at the Mewstone. There's no Mewstone around, you know. It's a drill they have to do, sort of thing, you know. The warming goes in a 50-year cycle. But at the moment, there is also a possible effect of man pushing that a bit, to make it a bit more extreme. And the plankton goes in 50-year cycle. And we published a paper in 1964 with my boss at the MBA. And he was Sir Frederick Russell. And this has been known now as the Russell cycle. And it's not clearly defined, but if you look at the details, you can see it there. And I worked with a zoologist at the MBA, who unfortunately is now dead, Dr. Alan Southwood, and we working on herring and pilchards. Now, this part of the world is very interesting because you get herring and pilchards, and which you get in abundance depends on the temperature of the water. The pilchards like it warmer than the herrings like it colder, and when you have cold spells you have herring here, and when you have warm spells you have pilchards, and that goes in a 50-year cycle, and we trace that back to about 1650, because the landings of herring and pilchards were taxed. The government had to raise a tax, and they raised it on the landings of herring and pilchards. So going back through the tax records, we could trace when there were herring and when there were pilchards. And then we had the Kew temperature records, and we took the Kew temperature records for the last 100 years, when we had the sea temperature records for 100 years from our own observations, and found a correlation factor, and then were able to calculate the sea temperatures back to 1650 when the Kew records start, and we got this nice cycle. This is probably the longest record there has been.